Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Sarah Burtis, registration number 39236, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Lucas, in this case. This afternoon, I plan to focus on issue one, and will rest on the briefs for the remaining issues unless the court has any questions on those. In this case, police officers used a two-step interrogation technique when they interrogated Mr. Lucas at the police station. At the direction of Officer Weaver, Mr. Lucas had been arrested at his home and taken to the police station. Once there, Officer Weaver interrogated him in an interrogation room for an hour and 20 minutes. Officer Weaver never gave Mr. Lucas his Miranda advisements. During that interrogation, Mr. Lucas made several incriminating statements. After the hour and 20 minutes, Mr. Lucas broke down crying and Officer Weaver ended the interrogation. For the next hour, Mr. Lucas remained in that interrogation room while various police officers and personnel came in to take blood and hair samples. After that, Sergeant Murphy came into the interrogation room. He told Mr. Lucas that he had been to his house and had seen the evidence there. He also said that he had talked to Officer Weaver and that he understands some of the stuff that's going on, but that he wanted to know everything and therefore had to talk to Mr. Lucas. At that point was when Sergeant Murphy first Mirandized Mr. Lucas. Sergeant Murphy then began to interrogate him further, making some similar statements that Officer Weaver had made of suggestions about why Mr. Lucas had been in Ms. Stilo's house the night before. And the interrogation continued and Mr. Lucas made further incriminating statements and then described the events of the night before in detail. Those facts show that the officers were using a two-step interrogation technique.
Pardon me for interrupting if I'm
sure.
The counsel.
Absolutely.
I understand that you're saying that circumstantially that suggests that, but we don't have any evidence in the record that the officers said, yeah, we were following the same sort of process that the United States Supreme Court described in Siebert, is there?
There is not. That's correct, Judge. The officers never testified, as the officer had in Missouri versus Siebert, that they were in fact using this two-step interrogation technique as they had been trained. However, in the plurality opinion in Siebert, in footnote 6, I believe, the court stated that it would be unusual and rare in most circumstances that an officer would be so forthcoming as the officer had been in that in Missouri versus Siebert.
I understand,
yeah.
But considering where Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion came out, focusing on the intent of the officers to do something like this,
right?
Aside from the inferences that you draw from the circumstances, we've got no direct evidence to say that they engaged in this technique, right?
We have no, that's correct to the extent that we have no testimony from the officers that is exactly what they were doing. That is absolutely correct. However, and it's also correct, Justice Kennedy's concurrence, as you state, was looking at the intent of the officers, whereas the plurality opinion was applying this five-factor test more from the suspect's or defendant's point of view. But even under Justice Kennedy's concurrence, and there's also some question of whether or not that is the narrower test to be applied. But even under that test, it is, I believe, nearly inconceivable to think that an officer would direct to have an individual taken into custody, bring them to a police station, put them in an interrogation room, interrogate them. I mean, he was asking questions. The state conceded below that this was a custodial interrogation. There was no dispute about that whatsoever. It's inconceivable that an officer in that position would not give a Miranda advisement. The U.S. Supreme Court has stated in Dickerson that Miranda has become part of our national culture. This is a more well-known case than probably virtually any other case, with few exceptions, that the U.S. Supreme Court has stated. Therefore, I think the fact that the officer was doing that without giving Miranda advisements, was doing an invalid custodial interrogation, an unconstitutional custodial interrogation, I think that is evidence enough to draw the inference that they were applying this two-step technique.
Ms. Burtis, the Siebert case came out, I think, a couple of months after the suppression hearing in this
Correct.
Case?
Correct. Yeah, about 2 months, I believe it was.
But given the fact that we didn't have anything before Siebert to indicate that this two-step process would be analyzed any differently than it was in Oregon versus Elstad, you can't say, can you, that at the time the interrogation was going on, the police knew it was an invalid two-step process?
I think that you can actually, Judge, respectfully, to disagree, because the U.S. Supreme Court took the Missouri v. Siebert case because there was a split in circuits on this very issue of how to apply Oregon versus Elstad. And Oregon versus LSAT is read as having a good faith exception. In that case, the officers were at the home of the child, of the juvenile boy, and asked him a few questions there. He made some statements and then brought him to the station. So I think there is, not to mention the fact that Miranda itself has, since that case has been decided, made it very clear that any time a suspect is in custody and being interrogated, Miranda advisements must be given. So while the courts and the police officers might not have had the clarity that Missouri versus Siebert gives us, to the extent a plurality opinion can give us clarity, the law itself was clear. And I think Oregon versus, even under Oregon versus LSTAT, the court erred in not suppressing the second statement. The help that Missouri versus Siebert gives this court, which it can apply de novo review to the application of law, because we're not contesting the facts of this, the interrogation and the issues decided by the court at the suppression hearing, solely the way it applied the law. I think that even under Oregon versus LSTAT, the court should have suppressed the second statements because of the distinction between the good faith versus bad faith failure to give a Miranda advisement.
Well, let's take a look at, we've talked about the Justice Kennedy's opinion, but let's look at the plurality for a second.
Sure.
And looking at the factors that the plurality lays out,
mm-hmm.
would you agree that in Siebert, you pretty much had a consistent interview, first one officer, then the second officer comes in and provides the Miranda advisement? Here, don't we have a break of an hour?
There is a break of an hour. I believe in Siebert there was a break of 20 minutes between the initial first confession, and then there was a 20-minute break, and then the Miranda advisement. We do have a break of an hour, but that's why the plurality in Siebert had a five-factor test. So that break in time is not the only thing for this court to consider. The other things to consider are the completeness and detail in the first interrogation.
And if I may stop you there.
Sure.
Here, in the first interrogation, don't we have Mr. Lucas saying things like, well, could have been me, and, you know, maybe, and I don't really know, I was pretty drunk. And then in the second one, doesn't he basically, pardon me for resorting to the vernacular, but cop to the whole thing?
He does after a certain point with Sergeant Murphy, that's correct. However, I think his statements in the first one, the over the amount of time, over the course of both interrogations between, which is why I think this is to be looked at as a continuing continuum of interrogation, he's making more and more inculpatory statements. And so he says, even in Officer Weaver's first interrogation, he says things like, right now it looks like I did it. Chances are I blacked out and wound up doing whatever was done. And at the very end, at 12:29 p.m. on that tape, he says, I'm probably the person who did it. That is virtually a confession at that point. He didn't go into all the details that he went into with Sergeant Murphy, but he did essentially confess to it to the point that the Miranda advisement was not effective. And as Missouri versus Siebert, and I think even Oregon versus LSTAT directs courts to look at, that's the question for the court to determine, is whether or not the Miranda advisement when given was effective. And he had essentially inculpated himself and said, you know, I'm probably the person who did it.
Well, in this case, does it matter that his defense, as it turned out, was that he was too intoxicated to form the necessary intent? Because in that event, the inculpatory statement, I may have been the person that did it, or I'm worried that I'm the person that did it, he never really contested that he did it at the trial, did he? And isn't that relevant to look at whether indeed the first interrogation was, well, the second was merely a continuation of the first?
I'm not sure if I entirely understand your question. It sounds, my view of it is that, and please stop me as soon as I'm not answering your question, but my view of it is that the statements were obtained in violation of his Fifth Amendment rights and therefore should have been suppressed. And so we look at whether or not the jury could have considered this evidence in determining whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that essentially what you're getting
at?
No,
what I'm looking at, I guess, so looking at the five factors again, one of the things we have to talk about is the completeness of the questions and answers that were posed in the first and the second interview.
Correct.
And the first interview, the interviewer essentially got nothing except, well, it could have been me, but I was so drunk, I have no recollection of it. I blacked out, I have no recollection. And in the second, what the second interviewer gets is a detailed step-by-step recitation of what happened, and it seems to specifically negate his argument that he was too intoxicated to form the intent because his recollection is so clear.
Well, that's certainly the way the prosecutor was using the statement at trial. However, for Mr. Lucas to have a fair trial and that statement should not have come in, they would have been more limited in the way that they were able to address the defense of voluntary intoxication. But as to the distinction between the level of detail in the first versus the second, the court does say for the first factor in the five-factor test, in, they're looking at the completeness and detail of the questions and answers in the first round of the interrogation, and they're looking at whether or not that interrogation was systematic, exhaustive, and managed with psychological skill. And they find in Siebert that it was. So while I do agree to the extent that he did not go into as much detail in the second interrogation, he did, by the end of that first interrogation, say, I probably am the one who did this, which is virtually a confession. And that was managed with psychological skill on the part of Officer Weaver, and that was exhaustive. It was an hour and 20 minutes, and he was crying by the end of it. So the fact that there was more detail gone into in the second interrogation is just the fact that it is a continuing set of interrogations. And essentially, Sergeant Murphy picked up at the point where Officer Weaver left off with the confession. And in that instance, the Miranda warnings are not going to be effective. Looking at it from the suspect's perspective, as we do in the five-factor test, he at that point had confessed. And so you get into that language from Siebert of, you know, bewilderment being an unlikely state of mind to make a knowing waiver of his Fifth Amendment rights. And then as to the Justice Kennedy's concurrence with the deliberate intent, I think that that is, as I stated before, clear from the fact of the manner in which Officer Weaver had the first interrogation happen, the fact that he did not Mirandize him at all. So I think under either standard or either test from Missouri versus Siebert, it's clear that this two-step interrogation technique was used in this case.
Let's assume for purposes of argument, Ms. Burtis, that we agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't this harmless?
Well, first, because it would be a constitutional harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Sure.
And for that standard to apply, the state would have to show that the guilty verdict was surely unattributable to the statements. And the state cannot show that here because, one, the videotape itself was actually played to the jury. After it was played, Sergeant Murphy then read to the jury the handwritten statement that Mr. Lucas had made during their interrogation.
But don't we also look to what the other evidence was? Isn't that also part of our analysis?
It can be to a certain extent, except that the question is not whether the guilty verdict would have been rendered without the evidence. The question is to what extent the jury relied on this evidence, this inadmissible evidence. And the state has the burden of showing that they surely did not attribute the verdict to that evidence. So because it was the DVD with the videotape was played, the statement was read, and then in closing argument, throughout closing argument, the prosecutor referred to the statement to prove both the fact that he was in the house, which I agree that there was some other evidence indicating that, but the question here is to what extent the jury relied on this inadmissible evidence. The prosecutor used it in closing argument to show that he had been in the house, and also, again, getting back to Judge Casebolt's question, to show the intent. And that was, the prosecution used it throughout closing, and then again in rebuttal argument, that he continually made statements about the level of detail that he went to in this incident, and those statements should have been kept out and were improperly relied on because they were obtained in violation of Mr. Lucas's Fifth Amendment rights. And so therefore, I don't think that the state at all can say that it's surely unattributable to those statements when the prosecution introduced it and relied on it so heavily in closing. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Pratt. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm appearing on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. Before I get into my argument on the Siebert issue, I want to correct a mistake in my brief on the issue of merger regarding the defendant's first-degree burglary conviction. The defendant was convicted of four crimes in addition to the first-degree burglary: first-degree criminal trespass, criminal tampering, assault, and menacing. My brief states in error that first-degree criminal trespass and tampering merges into the first-degree burglary charge, and this is not correct. The crime of first-degree burglary requires that either the crimes of assault or menacing, or that the defendant is carrying a deadly weapon, be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's also the jury instruction that the jury was given here. Since the jury convicted the defendant of both of these offenses, one of these predicate offenses merges into the first-degree burglary, unless there's a jury finding that the defendant was armed with a deadly weapon, in which case I would argue nothing would merge. When there's a merger, the object, of course, is to maximize the effect of the jury's verdict, and in order to do this, this court needs to take into account the length of the sentences that were imposed on the defendant in this particular case. Here, defendant was sentenced to 24 years for the first-degree burglary, 2 years for the assault in county court, 3 years for the 3 years for the menacing, in DOC. And so if anything were to merge, it would be the assault conviction, because that's the lesser of all of them. And in addition, the first-degree criminal trespass isn't a lesser-included offense because the proof that the defendant entered into a building, entered into a dwelling, is an element of criminal trespass that isn't in the first-degree burglary. And I apologize for any inconvenience that my errors may have caused the court. Now, turning to Siebert, this court can decide this issue in more than one way. The most expedient way has already been alluded to this afternoon, and that is to decide that any error in admitting the defendant's statement would necessarily be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard is whether the guilty verdict was surely not attributable to the admission of the defendant's statement. Now, the Martinez case that I cited in my brief looks at how you assess whether constitutional error occurred or not, and it looks at a number of factors. It looks at the importance of the statement to the prosecutor's case and how strong the prosecutor's case was without the statement itself. It looks at the cumulative nature of the evidence and the presence or absence of corroborating or contradictory evidence in the record. Now, here the case against the defendant was extremely strong. There were no facts presented in the defendant's statement that was read to the jury or on the tape that was not presented in other evidence to the jury. The defendant's statement was entirely cumulative to and corroborative of the victim's statement about exactly what happened when the defendant walked into the house.
Maybe the events were corroborated, but what about the mental state? Seems to be a big dispute about whether that was, whether he in fact could form the requisite mental state because of intoxication or not. How would the jury not rely upon his detailed statement in the second interview to overcome his contention that he was too intoxicated?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Sure, no, it's fine.
I think that you can infer that from the victim's statement and also the police testimony about what happened. The defendant disabled the victim's car. The defendant cut off the victim's electricity so that she couldn't call for help. The defendant was wearing certain clothing, a mask to obscure his appearance, and they found gloves and the knife all wrapped up that was hidden in a kitchen cabinet. From the gloves, from the cutting the victim access to the outside, from the mask, I think the jury could infer from the victim's and the police officer's testimony that very intent, that it was deliberate, that it was really antithetical to the idea that the defendant would be sober. Plus, I was thinking the victim woke up and heard something downstairs and then fell asleep and then woke up again and thought she heard the stairboards creeping, squeaking. But she didn't hear him falling down or stumbling around or looking for the light switch or doing what a visibly intoxicated person would do. And so I think you can infer that from her testimony. The other piece of testimony that's corroborative to the victim's statement that I did it, of course, is DNA evidence, which is proof beyond a reasonable doubt of identity. And there's no contradictory evidence that I could find whatsoever on this record. And I think for this reason, any error would necessarily be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the second way to decide this case would be to get in there and wrestle all of this down in terms of its facts and whether it's factually distinguishable from Siebert or not. In Siebert, the Supreme Court found that a deliberate, question first and warn later procedure would render the Miranda warning ineffective. But here, by contrast, we have an interview not warned, and then we have another interview that was warned. But that in and of itself is not enough for it to be close enough to Siebert. The evidence of police intent and the evidence to end run Miranda, I think, is a critical distinction in this particular case. Prior to Siebert, whenever we saw a Miranda warning on the record, followed by a waiver, that was always prima facie evidence of the defendant's waiver of his Fifth Amendment rights were knowing and intelligent. After Siebert, we reverse that presumption if we have direct evidence or a police policy, evidence from which you can say that the police deliberately intended to end run Miranda. But here we don't have that evidence. This means the presumption of the validity of the defendant's waiver is still on the record. We still have to have that presumption. That's been the presumption for decades since Miranda. Nevertheless, the defendant can still show the warning that he received was rendered ineffective by the particular procedure used by the police. The way to assess that, you look at the other factors that I think Justice Souter wrote about in Siebert, because he did say, look, we may not always have this admission, therefore you can rebut the presumption of validity another way. First of all, you can look at the detail of the questions asked in the first round of questioning, the overlapping content of the two statements, the timing and the setting, were they both in the same place, the continuity of police personnel. And the last one that was important is the degree to which the interrogator treats the second round as continuous to the first. Is it really just one big interview like it was in Siebert? Here we had the police officers doing the questioning not being the same people. The questions they asked weren't identical because the focus of both of these interviews was different. The first interview was really about the detective wanting to know why the defendant went inside the house, because you have a lot of facts that sort of point to the fact that maybe this was a sex offense, and I think he wanted to know that before. So what he did, because you know, you have the car being disabled, the electricity being disabled, you have him saying, I went in there to mess with her stuff to teach her a lesson, and yet he's going up the stairs to her bedroom. So Weaver was confronting him with all of this evidence and saying, you know, come on, let me know, what were you doing there? The second one was more a nuts and bolts after the Miranda warning. It was more of a nuts and bolts question. You know, how did it happen? Where were you the night before? What did you do? Where did you go? And exactly what happened? And so they're completely different in terms of the kind of information that was elicited and the entire sequence of events in terms of the questions. There was no indication that the second interview was treated as continuous with the first. In Siebert, it was so seamlessly done that it would have been hard for someone who was being interrogated to look up maybe in the second interview and realize that it wasn't really part of the first, because the same questions were being repeated. It was almost as though the first interview had never ended. And that, of course, didn't happen here. The judge also made a finding, I think, in the record that's important, and he found that the efforts of the police to persuade the defendant to tell them what happened did not rise to the level of coercive government conduct. And I think that finding is entitled to some deference by this court. Therefore, on this record, this court doesn't have enough information to invalidate the defendant's knowing and intelligent waiver of his rights. Now, the third way this court can decide this issue would be to find that the defendant did not raise this issue below. I knew when I wrote the brief that Siebert had come down afterwards, after the hearing, but the idea that police misconduct can invalidate an otherwise valid Miranda waiver has been out there. It was in Elstad. It was in Mendoza-Rodriguez, the Colorado case on Elstad. it's out there that, that police misconduct could invalidate it, and that wasn't raised. What was raised instead was the totality of the circumstances plus a fruit of the poisonous tree attenuation kind of argument. And this is just not a mere technical argument or a hurdle that the defendant has to raise in order to get into this court. It's really important that the defendant put the trial court on notice about what kind of findings the trial court is expected to make. And that's why, especially in a suppression or in a search and seizure context, you need to raise it. Because, I mean, when you don't, the claim becomes unreviewable on appeal.
Excuse me, counsel. My understanding is there was maybe a year between the hearing, the suppression hearing, and the trial, approximately.
I really don't know. I know it was before.
The reason for my question is, do you know if there was any effort to renew the motion after Siebert came down?
I don't know. I'm presuming that there probably was time, or not, like right before trial, to say, Your Honor, I want to revisit this issue because this new case came out. If there are no further questions, the people would respectfully request that the defendant's convictions and sentences be affirmed.
Thank you.
excuse me. The trial court did address Oregon v. Elstad in its ruling to admit the second statement, but to suppress the first one. In fact, it relied on that case to do exactly that. So this issue was presented to the trial court. Additionally, the two interrogations were not as distinct as the state would suggest. The Sergeant Murphy, repeated what Officer Weaver had suggested about the reasons for Mr. Lucas being in the house in any event, and so it was a continuing interrogation. If there are no further questions, I'd ask this court reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can be prepared on People v. Walden, we'll hear